by his stall every time that I was there. It's a shame, you know. I mean, this is what the world does for us, to us. You know, the great guys who become silent keys over the years. It's a shame. And good old Andy, may rest in peace. He was a very generous guy. He would go not only to Limark for Hamfest. He would basically go to any Hamfest on the East Coast that would have them. He asked, and they said, yeah, sure. And he was traveling all over the place. So down south, he would travel to Hamfest. Northeast, he would travel. So he was becoming pretty much a regular in most of the East Coast Hamfest for his tune-up table.
And what was it? I forget what Hamfest was up here, and the last I saw him, then he was at Nearfest, and that's when everybody's like, I just saw him, and they devastated over the news. Yeah, John wasn't in the best of health. John kept smoking and on oxygen there, so, but had a great heart there, and the last Hamfest was up in Meriden at the high school, and I won one of the door prizes that he turned around and was given away there, so, and I was shocked there. But anyway, so thank you for letting me in. I do listen in. I haven't attended in a long time since Dick passed away. Dick would have me do it certain times of the season because I'm in a local fire department here. You know, when people are starting to run their generators, people are starting up the wood stoves and stuff, you know, what things I come across and, you know, what technical things or safety things that you can put in since you go to all these things there. So, and I kind of missed that there. So, but anyway, thank you for letting me in. I want to say 7-3s, everyone. Have a good, safe evening in the rest of the week. W1WR.
N2Z Echo Alpha.
Yes, that Echo Alpha.
Hey guys, name's Glenn. Okay, question. I have a screwdriver antenna for the car for the HF. It's grounded with a braided cable. It's screwed to the frame of the car, and about every 6 months or so it corrodes, and I've got to take it off, clean it, and put it back on. Is there a way to permanently attach it so it doesn't corrode?
Do you know offhand what the metals are all about? Because it sounds like there's some case of galvanic reaction. You have dissimilar metals. If you could somehow either change the metal to something that's the same type or a more neutral adapter that wouldn't have galvanic response, it might corrode much slower. So do you know what the metals are that are involved? I imagine the braiding is copper, so what is it attached to?
Braiding is copper, but it's tin, so it's covered with lead, I suppose. The frame of the car is steel, and I've scraped off all the coverings for it, and it's just screwed with a bolt into both together. But it's under the car, and salt gets in there from the road, and it doesn't last long.
Yeah. You probably not going to. I don't know. It's curious whether it pays to kind of. What would be a good metal to act as an interface? Because I don't think you're going to really get a braid that's not going to be copper in one way or another. I mean, there are aluminum, but you know, most of them are going to be copper. So probably there's some other metal. I don't know. I have to look up the electronegativity. Steel and copper are going to have a galvanic response. They have differing electronegativities. If you add moisture, it's going to act like a battery, and it's going to corrode. So you would need something to kind of bridge the electronegativity between steel and copper. I'd have to kind of look that up in a table. Anyone out there with experience with galvanic problems and corrosion and who found a solution without looking it up in a table, if you want to share the information, please hit the push to talk.
to know if there's a way to bond it with a weld or just brazing it, maybe something like that.
Well, the problem is that you're still going to have the same electronegativity. It's a galvanic response. Different metals hold on to electrons with a different strength. And so if you have two different metals with two different electron strengths, they're going to go in one direction. And that's what corrosion is. So if you bond it to an intermediary, you might be able to lessen the extent of the response. In other words, if you know, things like copper really hold on to electrons, steel not so much. So it's just the force of the electronegativity difference is what's causing the accelerated corrosion. So there's probably some kind of intermediary metal that would kind of slow down the corrosion effect. What that would be offhand, I don't know, but try looking it up. Look up galvanic response. Look up corrosion, dissimilar metals, and you might get some good information from the Internet.
Great. Point me in the right direction. Thank you. N2 Zenical Alpha 73.
You're welcome. Good luck. And if you find something interesting, please come back and tell us.
WS2N.
See you at the handset.
Yes, Paul?
Yeah, maybe some kind of brass, if you can find a brass bolt, brass washes, that type of thing. Brass is a good intermediate between copper and steel. You know, you have that in your general piping if you're hooking up to a boiler or something like that. You have steel and then you have copper going into it. What really helps to eliminate the galvanic action is brass, and you know, a lot of times you have a brass valve, which is good enough. And if you have a situation where you don't need a valve, you just get a brass coupling, and it works good for that. So I would imagine if you can get a brass bolt and a couple of brass washes. And, you know, to tie it in that way, I think that would help. Back to you.
Okay, that's a good idea, Paul. Yeah, brass, of course, is copper and zinc alloy. And so it has an intermediate electronegativity and lesser galvanic response. So, yeah, and they're usually relatively easy to get. Just have to make sure that they're real brass and not just something that is to sort of vaguely look like them. But that's a great idea, Paul. Thank you.
That sounds like a plan. Thank you very much. 7-3, guys.
Okay, Doug. Another satisfied customer, as Dick used to say. Anyway, the night is still young, gentlemen. I'd love to say gentlemen and ladies, but I think the last time we had a female come by the technical net to discuss something was maybe about a year ago, unfortunately. But nevertheless, the night is young, and we're still open for business. So if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, feel free to hit that push to talk give away with your questions. Yeah, could you speak a little bit louder? I think that's Alex.
Yeah, I will. I'm going to wait for baby. So this may be a quick question. What size ground rod should I buy? I saw a bunch of different options on Amazon, and I know they're probably for different applications. Is there a ground rod that's too small for radio? Some of them seem pretty large.
Well, you know, it's sort of like RF chokes. There's really no such thing as a ground rod that's too long. You limit it because, especially if it's a solid copper ground rod, it gets expensive after the first few feet. But the longest that you think you could drive into the ground is probably going to be functionally the best. At least 4 to 6, and, if you're so inclined, 8. If anyone out there has any specific length that they really love, feel free to tell us.
Hey, do you get a big drill bit? I have rocky soil, so do I need to get a rubber head mallet? Or can I get a sort of drill bit that'll go down 4 feet?
It's probable that there are 4 foot drill bits out there. I never came across them because I never really needed quite that long. I did buy an oversized drill bit. I think they were about 18 inches or 24 inches to just go through my brickwork and such. Again, a question, unfortunately, I don't exactly know. I would imagine it can get kind of expensive, so you might be better off, you have a rocky ground, so you can't just kind of hammer through it. Anyone with any good ideas about, whether there are 4 foot drill bits out there that people could use for making holes for their ground rods?
Comment?
Yeah, sure, please, comment.
Yes, this is Gate 2BCB. James, if you go to an alarm supply company, they usually have the 4 foot drills that you could probably buy that are very inexpensive. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Alex, there you got a solution. I never actually went for the 4 foot long ones, but apparently they're available.
That's helpful. I'm interested in what an alarm supply company is doing with them. That's a good tip. I'll take a look around Westchester for that. Another note, Roy. I'm just going to ask, I see some radios have 10 meters FM. Is that even used by anyone, or are these just import radios people are hacking to use it on a TV which uses FM? Is anyone actually transmitting
10
meter FM?
Yes, they are. Matter of fact, a year or two ago, we had a gentleman who unfortunately bought one of those thinking that he was going to use it for the single sideband part of the band. But every so often you will come across repeaters that have frequencies on 10 meters. And those are FM radio repeaters. So, yes, 10 meters does have areas where people use FM. Usually it's a frequency for a repeater. And usually they're linked to other bands as well.
Okay, interesting. Thank you. I've woken up the baby, Roy. I've got to go back to listen only. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry for being part of that. Next time we'll try even talking quieter. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Limark Technical Net, and we're still open for business if people are interested. If you have any questions or comments or topic for discussion, hit that push to talk and bring them on.
WS.
Yes, Paul?
I remember years, decades ago, getting on FM 10 meters. And, I worked some of the repeaters. So when the band was open, a repeater might be in think one of them was in an island somewhere. And you'd go into that repeater and you would talk to other people. But what I liked about it was the simplex frequency that was common at the time. I don't remember what it was. Back then, you know, it was all kind of new. There were a bunch of people on, and you know, you could work people, you know, thousands of miles away. Real good DX, and the sound was just phenomenal. You know, it was the FM. It was a lot of fun. I don't know what's on it now, but it was doable even decades ago. Back to you.
Ah, good to know. Yeah, when the subject of 10-meter repeaters comes up, I always wonder the legalities, because I believe the FM 10-meter band is not within the technician's access. So if you unfortunately are talking on 2 meters or 70 centimeters on a repeater that's linked to 10 meters, is that considered a violation? Because you are transmitting your signal into the 10-meter band away from the technician's portion. So I always kind of wondered of the legal aspects of that.
You're supposed to be on a band that you're supposed to be on. You're okay. What it's coming out on, that's the responsibility of the repeater who's ever running that. So, yeah, that would be no problem. And, I'd like to try it again. But, you can look it up. You can probably still find the repeater, the frequencies and the simplex. The simplex was, that's what I really liked. You know, I didn't do it a lot, but I remember doing it probably in, it had to be early 1990s, I guess. Back to you.
Oh, okay. I mean, this would be a very interesting time to play around with that because, you know, the bands are open. As Sam and Rich mentioned earlier in the technical net, the CQ contest, single sideband CQ contest, was jumping all over the darn place. It was, you couldn't find a single kilocycle to call your own. So, 10 meters is kind of open during this fall and winter. Most likely when we get to the spring, we'll have the same unfortunate geomagnetic storms that screwed things up for the last 3 years in a row. But this certainly is a good time to experiment on 10 meters if you're so inclined. I still remember the poor guy, unfortunately, he's since become a silent key. And he thought he would join us on my 10-meter net that I have every Sunday morning. And unfortunately, not knowing, he bought a purely FM mode 10-meter transmitter that obviously wouldn't work for a single sideband net. So, unfortunately, yet another silent key. Anyway, this is AC2GS. Any comments, any questions, any topics, feel free, hit that push to talk.
And Roy, one other thing. The back then, of course, we had five different. You could be a novice, you could be a technician, general, advanced. We had the advanced, the extra. So it was very confusing of what band you could be on and which one you couldn't be on. And everybody was there with their charts. You know, I mean, they do it now too, but you really needed it back then. What frequency am I on, you know? It was a lot of fun. Back to you.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's a few people out there that I've bumped into don't really check their charts very well, and, their friends sort of unfortunately let them get away with it. But, I'm sure it got very confusing. I think there were two subcategories of technicians. I forget what the other one was, but I vaguely remember hearing about two different technicians classes.
I remember that. No, no, we had novice technicians and some extra, you know. So, yeah. But what happened was well, some guys would pass the written part, but they didn't pass the code, and they had to wait to take the test again to get the proper license. It was totally different. Now we just have the three of them. Much easier.
It certainly seems that way. Is when you have to consider testing people as well. There are still people, though, out there who have a legitimate advanced license because they grandfathered them. If you wanted to, you could take the test and upgrade to an extra. But if you didn't want to, you'd stay in the log books as an advanced.
Yeah, I've worked a couple of people like that, and you look them up on QSN, and it says advanced. I said, wow, that's true.
Yeah, it didn't work that way with novice, because novice was always meant as a temporary classification, and you could age out of it if your license was too old. So we don't have any old novices out there, just some advanced and a lot of technicians and the generals and extras.
G2RY, good evening.
Good evening, David. How are you this fine day?
Oh, I can't complain. Just chilling out here. You know, on 20 meters, there is a net for advanced class and extra class only. It's 14.213. It's led by a man who, he offers some kind of award, you know, for being in advanced.
Okay, I mean, that's kind of a time-based situation. You could have the greatest motivation in mankind, but you can't go from anything to an advanced nowadays. It's not available on the exam. So, you know, it's kind of frozen in amber.
Well, in 2015, when I renewed my license, I think it was 2015, they asked for me if I wanted to get a vanity call sign, and I said, okay, you know, I checked the box, and they sent to me this call sign, and I didn't ask them for any particular call sign. If you are an advanced. AG2RY.
I'm sure WS1.
Sorry, I fell out of All-Star. So they gave you a vanity call sign without asking you what you wanted your vanity call sign to be?
QSL. I didn't know that I had to pick the call sign. I thought that it was up to the licensor.
Well, yeah, I guess it's different for different situations, but, you know, some people, offer a bunch of choices. You know, they'll list their top 10 choices, and, you know, if they're not able to give you the first, say, 7, they'll give you the 8. But I never heard where they just randomly give you a random vanity. It strikes me as being not much of a vanity call sign if you're not the one who has any say in it.
Well, basically, I lost a letter. You know, this call sign 2x2, which is basically the format for advanced. I don't know if advanced also is 1x3.
I think it was actually part of the exam. You were supposed to know what different classes have access to what different, 1x2, 2x4, whatever, 2x3.
Well, it's true. I mean, if you look at the regulations, I'm not sure where you would find this. Maybe in the FCC website, I don't know. And you'll see, for qualification, extra class can get a 4-digit call sign. You know, they can get a 4-digit call sign. I don't know about 1x3. I know about 2x2.
I think theoretically you could get a 1x1, but they're all kind of locked down as, event station designations or clubs or something that people got many, many years ago and won't release. So, the best you can kind of get is a 1x2 or a 2x1. And, of course, as an extra, if they incrementally give the person who passes his extra exam, they give people the 2x2, starting with A and going down the incremental list.
QSO. Yeah, I thought that 2x2. 2x2 is for advanced class. I probably think that, any class higher than advanced also would qualify. I just don't know why, they would do that.
Was this through the FCC or was this through a third party like the ARRL?
It could be the ARRL. They might have a description of the call signs and the classes.
Yeah, as far as I could recall, the ARRL was kind of nice about that they would renew your license for you, and if you were interested in a vanity or just the concept of a vanity, they would kind of do the legwork. So probably that's what happened. That someone over there in the ARRL said, would you like me to find you a vanity call sign? And you said yes, and so they went off on their own, because I don't think FCC handles it like that. Like I said, the usual method that I heard of is you have to submit to the FCC a list. In other words, you can give them a list of one, but, if for whatever reason they decide that they can't give you that call sign, then that's where it ends. So you can give as many as 10 different call signs, and they'll just go down the list until they find one that they think is acceptable, and then they give it to you. Otherwise, I don't think there's that much thought going on at the FCC about the call sign.
It was a paper document you had to fill out, and there was a checkbox for vanity call sign. I don't remember if there was a space where you write the call sign that you want.
I would think so. I mean, most of the people I know who were interested in vanity call signs had something in mind at the time.
It's all good, I think that it's not possible for any person to have the same vanity call sign as somebody else. So maybe that's a really good thing.
WSON.
Yes, Paul. One second. That's the whole idea of call signs. They're unique identifiers. There should not be an active radio operator in the world that has your call sign. It's yours until you lapse your license, and then it goes into the pool again and can be taken by other people. Yes, Paul?
Yeah, I remember I had to take a choice of they wanted you to choose four different ones, you know, so you go through the whole list, whatever you want, what you think sounds best. You put your preference up first, and you hope you get that one. You know, I was glad to get away from my original call. KB2BPB was very long for CW, so to be able to do that, which, you know, I was concentrating on how each one sounded on CW. And sure enough, I got the one I was looking for. It was available at that time. WS2N. BC?
Yeah, I... Yeah, Rich?
I was just going to say that what I did, my original call when I was a novice was WN2BZZ. And then when I got the tech, it was WB2BZZ. So finally, when I went all the way to Extra, I applied for the vanity call sign, also, Paul, for CW reasons, and I just shortened it to W2BZ from WB2BZZ. So that was easy to do, and thank God for Andy, our silent key Andy. Remember, he... for some reason, looked up my call and noticed that it was about to expire, and I had no idea when it was going to expire. So I very well could have lost my call sign if it wasn't for Andy. And by the way, I tried everything on this mag loop, and no readings have changed. I'm missing something. I don't know what it is.
Comment?
Sure, comment away.
I just wanted, this is Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf. My novice was WN2RGR. And I couldn't think of, you know, I didn't like that call sign. Someone said, well, you could try WN2 Romantic Gruesome Robert, but it had no panache. But when I recently got my amateur extra, I created a call sign for AE, for Amateur Extra 2 for New York, and I have Yankee Golf, because I'm a Yankee, meaning I'm from New York, and golf is my other hobby, so I thought that was a good way to put it together, so Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf. Well, now I'm into CW, I'm participating in CW Academy, and I realized that with Foresight, you really should gear it towards the CW at its, position. I mean, also for DXing, but, so, it's just interesting that as you get more experience, you sort of hone the skills as to what call sign you're going to try to get. Anyway, that's my comment and story. Thank you.
How much does it cost for a license plate?
Ah, a vanity license plate. Anyone know DMV prices these days?
I think the last time I looked, it was like $120 or something like that.
I don't know. I never had a call sign license plate.
You don't see them much anymore. I used to see them a lot.
Cars,
not much anymore.
And when I do, I usually honk and wave for 2 years,
and they know exactly they're talking to or they're waving to another ham. Paul, can I? I mean, Roy. Can Could you explain what you meant by you can't test a capacitor when it's in circuit and get the same readings as when it's out of circuit?
It's like taking a resistor that's in circuit and testing its resistance while it's in circuit. Everything else connected to it is going to have an effect on the measurable resistance. You can't measure capacitance on a tuned network because there's an inductor in parallel with it, which distorts the reading. You have to remove at least one of the two leads out of the circuit in order to test it in the testing device. Otherwise, the other component, discrete components, interact with the test equipment and gives you a different answer.
N1YDY comment?
Yes, thanks.
Yeah, I'm a little late, but you were asking how much a vanity plate costs, and I just renewed my mom's vanity plates on her car, and it was $204 for 2 years.
Ah, very good. Thank you, Hank.
You know, I saw a man had ham radio plates. And on the back window, he had the 10-meter frequency that he was on.
Okay, I mean, very informative guy. Paul, what do you want to say?
Get whatever you want, and you pay big money for it. But at one time, if you got a ham radio license, and you got a ham, you know, you put in for that, this is probably the early 1990s. It was only $5, you know. I mean, I never did it. To me, you know, well, the job sites I would go to, I was worried about it. That was like putting a sign on your car, you know. There's a radio in this car, you know. So I never got one. But back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I never particularly went for vanity plates. I thought of getting them for MD plates, but at that point, you know, no doctor did house calls, and you didn't get away with almost anything with having MD plates. I remember once being ticketed for parking in front of a hospital, so I never invested in vanity plates for anything, including amateur radio.
Way back when, MD plates used to mean that there were drugs in the trunk.
Well, I guess perhaps, but not necessarily. I mean, I never carried drugs in my car. It depends on the neighborhood and what have you. But, you know, in the very old days, you could park in front of a fire hydrant if you had MD plates, because the point was that it might be a medical emergency and you were making house calls, and just life was a little bit easier back then. Nowadays, you know, if you told the cop that you were doing a house call, they'd probably laugh at you and give you two tickets.
They knew what a house call was in the first place.
That's true. A lot of younger police officers don't have a particularly historical mind.
I remember when TV repairmen used to come to your house, and one time we gave our TV repairmen measles, which I'll never forget.
Weren't you guys generous? Actually, I had a TV repairman come about 12 years ago. I had a flat screen TV. I think it's the same one I have now. It's in warranty that had a failure. A completely different form of life than a TV repairman that I remember as a child, you know, where they would bring vacuum tubes and test equipment and all kinds of things. This guy came up, unscrewed the back, popped a large PC board module, went back to the truck, came up with a replacement module, plugged it in, screwed the back on, turned it on, and he was gone. So that was in the age of the disposable modules. They didn't really test anything. They just replaced massive portions of the TV under warranty.
Yeah, these guys came with DOMs and poop testers and who knows what. They were the real deal back then.
Yeah, well, like everything else, it's not cost-effective. They don't want to employ people with the technological expertise to test components. They just, set up a little algorithm. There's only about five different modules in any given TV set. So if you replace module A and it doesn't work, then try replacing module B and, repeat as needed until you get a solution to the problem. And then they probably take it back into the office and either send it back to the factory where it's junked or junk it themselves. God forbid anyone just sits there and tests components. But that's our future, Even the repair people, even the technicians aren't quite sure how anything works these days.
Comment?
What about the ribbon cables?
What about ribbon cables?
Inside, where I come, I see 718, It's not the newest radio, But the idea is it has to be constructed to fit inside that box. And, the circuit boards are connected with ribbon cables.
Yeah, well, that's particularly for small form factor electronics. Everything is surface mount and the size of small grains of rice, and so everything is, the circuit boards are flexible in many cases as well. Sam, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say two things. One is you can't even get a person on the phone anymore, so forget about repair people coming to the house. You can't even reach a human being when you call a service center. My other comment refers to obsolescence. There was an article in Atlantic Magazine, I was going to send it to you, Roy, where they're talking about the early versions of the EVs, electric vehicles, are going to be turning into bricks because the technology is so far advanced that they can't update the old system. So they're turning them into bricks. That was the story in the Atlantic Magazine.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that's not at all unusual. As technology evolves, people are convinced that their old stuff has no value, it's all junk, and you should throw it away and buy a shiny new one. So, I mean, gone are the days that, you had your grandfather's pocket watch or anything like that. That's one of the things that kind of annoyed me with the concept of the Apple Watch. I have watches that I bought 50 years ago, and they're fine. If I had a 50-year-old electronic digital watch, it would probably be worthless. The batteries wouldn't be available. There'd be no replacement parts for the inside. It was just, you could put it under a glass and show people. But otherwise, what would you do with an electronic watch 20 or 30 years after you bought it, other than use it as a doorstop?
Teslas, the early Tesla vehicles are going to be bricks shortly.
Well, I've already read loads of different reports. Once you're out of warranty and the batteries go on you, that's a major hit that most people weren't really expecting. I think there was some story of a guy who, in order to get out of warranty swapping batteries, it would have cost him $17,000. So he decided to make a point by driving it up to a mountain and then just kind of throwing it over. I mean, I'm sure he ended up having to pay all kinds of fines for that. He made the news, but, unfortunately, electronic vehicles, a significant amount of their price is the batteries. And the batteries have a very finite lifespan, and the cost of recycling them is not trivial. So you can't just kind of, throw them into a hopper with tin cans, melt them down, and then reconstitute them. So, yeah, it's a big problem. This disposable economy that we have is going to be rather expensive as time goes on.
Another comment, N1YDY.
This is a different type of charging system, and the old ones have the old-fashioned charging system. You could be driving your vehicle and not be able to get a charge because it's antiquated to what's available out on the road these days. So that's another factor.
Yeah, technologies change, connector technology changes. Hank, you wanted to say something?
Yes, getting back to the battery cost, the Hyundai Ioniq, there was a case it was on television on 60 Minutes, I believe, where a guy hit a rock that punctured the battery case from the bottom, and it was $64,000 to get a replacement battery shipped from Japan. And the number just stuck in my mind.
Yeah, well, it would do more than stick in my mind if I had to pay something like that. Yeah, I don't quite understand the economics of things like that. I mean, it's just public relations. I mean, if you want to kind of kill a model, just have it go into the news of price tags or something like that. You know, you think these guys are better businessmen than to let things like that dangle in the breeze.
Comment, KE2GOG.
Sure, comment away.
But before I got my ham license, I was listening to you guys, and one of the topics was, vehicle batteries and charging stations, and I still wanted to comment then, and now you guys are talking about it, similar conversation. At that point, I wondered why they don't make common batteries across all platforms so you can just go get change, go to a battery change gas station, if you will, and you don't even need to charge it anymore. You just drive up, they pop the bottom out, they pull the battery pack out, you drop another battery pack in, and off you go.
Well, I mean, there were more than a few companies long before electric cars had a rebirth, because they started 100 years ago. Sony, I'm sure you've owned many pieces of Sony equipment. Sony, back in the good old days, refused to have anything that wasn't proprietary. They had their own thumb drives. They had their own batteries. They had their own connectors. Because if you did things like that and people needed replacements, you could charge a lot more. Apple, up until very recently, and it's only due to the EU, had proprietary connectors. So there was no choice in the matter. And if you wanted a legitimate one, it had to be certified by Apple, and Apple charged you for that certification. So I think it's an economic annoying thing. Plus, I guess it's bragging rights. You want to advertise that you want to buy our electric vehicles because our electric vehicles have state-of-the-art technology that all the other companies don't. And if they all had the same damn batteries, you couldn't really say that. So I think profits is the reason why proprietary components are still a major nuisance.
Comment?
Sure.
It's interesting because I understand with Tesla, you can have the same engine, but due to the electronics, they control how much horsepower it generates. So therefore, it have the same machine, but if you buy the cheaper model, it's rigged to have less performance. But if you buy the more expensive vehicle, the same engine is rigged or programmed to deliver more horsepower. I think that's an interesting issue there.
Yeah, well, I guess they're kind of hoping that they don't get their bottom sued out from under it. I mean, Apple got into a big problem. One of their operating systems would kind of poll how old your iPhone was, and if it was a certain age, it would limit the amount of charge that the battery would be given. So it would seem that your battery was beginning to fail when it was simply a software issue. I think they had a big suit about that and had to hand over a nice little lump of money to the lawyers. So, you know, it's a shame that people don't go to Tesla and sue their backsides out. I think as time goes on, Tesla starts to lose some of these court cases that they used to all win, there'll be more and more people circling the business for the last few bucks that it has.
WA2BDH with a comment.
Sure, John.
Yeah, this is all part of the planned deterioration that we see. You see it in many different aspects of the thing. The interesting thing is, of course, amateur radio runs counter to that. Our whole idea of building of home brewing and everything, which still goes on, sort of runs counter to that, which is why some manufacturers have gotten out of the ham radio manufacturing business. But yeah, it's all the planned deterioration. Okay?
Yeah, I mean, planned obsolescence is not new. I think it was first promoted by the light bulb industry over 110, 120 years ago. Back in those days, your light output was not great, but the longevity, I think there's a few Edison bulbs out there that are still in working order. Hams run counter to all of this, unfortunately. If you want to lose your money, go into ham radio business and promote the latest, greatest, shiny, sparkly radio. You will cave in to a society that is much more interested in how much it costs and how to maintain it. We don't really go. We're not the typical Apple customer where, every year they tweak something and come out with another model of iPhone and you have to get it. And it's only $1,200, so what the hell? I'll have two. We're different. I've never bumped into any kind of a... I like Terminator 2, but I don't think there's a place for it right here. But anyway, I don't know what to tell you, but you're not going to make a lot of money in the amateur radio business. I haven't bumped into any retailer that kind of was thrilled with his profit. It was like squeezing rocks for blood. Anyway, that's our little discourse on economics 101. We're still relatively safe from it, I think. A planned obsolescence doesn't strike me. I mean, there's some really bad electrical engineering designs that I can't explain almost any other way. There's a Kenwood HT, not the present version, but the previous version that apparently... If you turned it on while it was in the charging bay, it would sometimes short out the power regulating chip, and you needed to have someone do a resolder on those damn things. So that was really a strange flaw in a very expensive HT. Those things go for about $500. Anyway, once again, I'm AC2GS. The name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We still have a little bit more time if anyone's interested. So if you have any questions or comments or topics that you'd like to discuss tonight, please hit that push to talk.
I have a question, Roy.
Sure.
You were were talking before about the early days of amateur radio licensing, I think back in the 60s. Do you remember the person who administered the test? It was down at the FCC office. I think it was on Barrack Street, or it was in Lower Manhattan somewhere. I remember him distinctly. I remember he smoked a cigarette in a cigarette holder, and I remember taking my CW test there. I remember him standing over me listening to my fist on CW. I used to remember his name, but I remember distinctly he smoked a cigarette in a cigarette holder. Do you remember who that was?
Personally, no. When I got licensed, it was through VEs. If anyone else out there remembers, I mean, I knew about the machinations of the FCC when I was a youngster because I used to listen to Gene Shepard on WOR on the radio, and one of his many great stories was when he went to the FCC office to take his amateur radio exam, and you know, he even described that that was before multiple choices. He got handed a piece of paper and he was told, you know, draw a Colpitts oscillator and include the values for the discrete components. So I sort of knew about it, but I wasn't really part of it. If anyone out there knows the gentleman's name, please hit that push to talk.
I don't know his name, but I remember the room. It was a gunmetal, government-issued desk and a sickening green wall. That's all I remember. And I think it was Barrack Street.
KBTY with a comment.
Sure.
Thanks, Roy, and everybody that's filming that tonight. Aside from my novice exam, which I took with my Elmer, I took my exams all at the FCC office at Barrack and Houston in Lower Manhattan. Number of years ago. Barrack and Houston. And yes, the description of the room to take the exam is just embedded in my mind. So, just a little sidebar. Barrack and Houston, I don't remember the gentleman's name. There were ladies there that graded your exam, and you knew right then and there. And, yeah, all of them. Barrack and Houston. 73. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Yeah, John?
Yes, yeah, it was Barrack Street. I remember because at that time I was going to RCA Institute, which was at, their building was at 350 West 4th Street before they moved uptown. And I remember walking from the RCA Institute's building there down to Barrack Street. It was walking distance. I remember I had to pass by all of the meat packing plants there on the west side. And finally, I got to the FCC office at Barrack Street. Yes, I do remember that. I remember the room also.
Ah, the good old days. I assume from Gene Shepard's story that related his taking the exam must have been in the late 30s, that at that point they didn't grade it and tell you the results because, you know, unless, you know, just for the sake of storytelling, the way he told the story was, he had to wait something like 4 to 6 weeks, and he got a postcard that told him he passed. That was the end of his little story. So I assume, especially, you know, it was probably when they did multiple choice, they could have the secretaries score the papers. If they were going to draw Colpitts oscillators, probably you needed to have the engineers grade your paper for you. So maybe that was the difference.
The exams were much tougher back then. You had to draw circuits. I remember, I think it was, you had to draw a circuit for a Class D amplifier or something like that. But with all the components around them and everything, you had to draw it. and I'm talking about 1964, something like that.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, unfortunately or fortunately, you don't have to be an electrical engineer to pass the present-day exams.